Hi, and welcome to the second episode of the Risk Management Magazine and Risk Management Monitor Blogs podcast, the Risk Cast. I'm Bill Coffin, publisher and editorial director of Risk Management Magazine, and with me is my editorial staff, Emily Holbrook.
Hello.
Morgan O'Rourke.
Hello.
And Jared Wade.
Hey.
Thanks for joining us. We've got a couple interesting stories lined up here to talk about today. I think what we'd like to go into first is a story that I started following this yesterday. But it's actually been going on for a good portion of the month. On November 5th, there's an unusual armored car heist happened in France, which just immediately captured my imagination because I love crime stories and I love reading about clever criminals, and so many of them are not clever. And what happened is this guy, a Loomis armored car guard in France named Tony Musselin, basically he had been working for the company for 10 years, perfect employee. No reason to believe that he was up to anything. Just normal day at work, whatever. He was the shift, I guess, commander, whatever. He was a top guard in a 3-man crew. They did all their errands. They stopped off at the Bank of France, last jump of the day. He sent out the two guys in the car to do one last errand in the bank, and then he just took off with the truck and left with about $17.2 million in unmarked euro bills. So it was this massive heist. He just vanished. And it was kind of funny because the authorities thought he'd been kidnapped originally because he just disappeared. They didn't see the car or anything. Then the car was later found, and then they realized that this guy, he had cleaned out his bank account. He had about 100,000 euros in his bank account. And then he had also bought a $250,000 Ferrari last year. So, and this is for a guy who gets paid about $3,000 a month to be a security guard. So, very unusual situation kind of arose. He became this anti-hero.
He bought the Ferrari before he stole the money?
Yeah. No. This is a weird thing.
His first rodeo, probably.
You're right. Well, I mean, he gets paid crap, right? He gets paid $3,000 a month, okay? Mm-hmm. So it's about $750 a week to guard millions and millions of dollars in a big truck, right? Obviously, there's no way he legitimately came into the quarter mil he needed to buy the Ferrari. He then somehow also had another like $150,000 in a bank account. It was sitting around, so he cleaned that up before he took off.
Right.
So the authorities quickly thought it was an inside job. Turned out it was just him. So apparently he's been planning it for a long time. People in France go nuts over this. They love this guy. There are websites dedicated to him. There are fan sites. There's like a Facebook fan site came up and got 1,000 fans in the first day. And people just went crazy for this dude. It all had kind of an anticlimactic ending because yesterday he turned himself in Monaco after 11 days on the run. And apparently he came in sort of in a state of confusion. The authorities weren't really sure why he turned himself in or whatever.
Especially since he had 17 million.
Well, actually, he didn't have 17 million. They recovered about 9 million of it a few days later after the heist. But there's still about 3.5 million unaccounted for, and he's not talking at all. He's being very uncooperative. He won't give it up. And people in France are basically like, yeah, this is a great job. He's, you know, when they try him for this, he's probably only going to get about 3 years in jail. So the prevailing attitude is, yeah, you know, this guy who ripped off millions from a bank.
Is he only getting 3 years in jail?
Well, apparently the thing is that because he stole all this money without even threatening violence, he just drove off with it. It's a very nonviolent crime, so they're charging him for theft. Obviously, they're also charging him for fraud because before he did the theft, he reported his Ferrari stolen. And apparently, what happened is the guy has family and ties in the Balkans. Apparently, he drove his Ferrari to Serbia, stashed it there somewhere, reported it stolen, and then ripped off all the cash. So they're going to hit him for fraud. As well, but mainly just because they're looking for anything to throw at him so he does more than 3 years jail time. Because what the authorities are concerned with is that, I mean, you can only imagine how bleak the feeling against bankers and financiers and all that is in this country. Apparently, it's even worse in France. So people are really worried that, given the large amount of public sympathy this dude already has, if he gets off with only 3 years, people go,
Everybody will steal from everything.
Well, yeah, he's getting paid $1 million a year to sit in jail. Yeah. You know, it's like people are like, I can do that, sure.
So how
you
much
know?
Money is the bank out that they haven't recovered or anything like that?
About $3.5 million. And he's being uncooperative. He won't. You know, it's kind of like, remember that big art theft in the Ava Gardner Museum up in Boston? Like 20 years ago, these guys stole like 300.
Before my time.
You're right. No, but these guys stole like $300 million worth of art.
Right.
And the one guy who's the legend mastermind, he still has never said where the art is. And everybody's just concerned that the reason why is because he plans to sell it once he gets out. He stashed it, and once he gets out of jail, he'll sell it.
The Ava Gardner Museum?
Yeah, I probably got it wrong.
Ava Gardner's a movie star?
Yeah, that's a movie star. Well, sorry.
I know it's the Gardner Museum.
It's not Ava Gardner, though.
Yeah, I don't think it's the Ava Gardner Museum.
Yeah, I'm a little wrong there.
Really
sorry.
Awesome museum and a great movie career. But regardless, they did steal a lot of art, yes.
Yes. I think the authorities are trying to worry about this, becoming a copycatted sort of thing. But, what immediately, brings to mind from a risk management perspective is this. You've got a guy, obviously, a company like Loomis must do background checks on all of its people, right? And he's been working for them for 10 years, apparently had a spotless history, a bit of a loner, but not like – he wasn't giving off crazy signals or anything like that. He's just, normal guy. He's not getting paid really a pittance when you consider the value of what he's being asked to not steal. Every day you go to work as an armored car driver, you're undergoing a morality check of am I or am I not going to drive off with this big pile of cash. And it was a big pile of cash. I mean, the photos of the money it was 50 stacks of bills. It took up a whole,
a whole truck.
It would, fill this office with money. I mean, it was a huge pile of money.
And this is a gigantic office.
It is.
Sweeping views.
Cavernous.
Sweeping views.
And there are already piles of money everywhere.
Exactly. So, but the point is that it seems like the first thing you want to do is pay these guys more,
right.
Perhaps. I just double their salary, something. I mean,
did you say he was disgruntled or had any sort of thing like that? Was there any history of that sort of stuff?
Yeah, wasn't he upset about something?
You said he's a loner, but I guess.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a good point. Apparently, one of his coworkers said, very shortly before the robbery, he had said, they'll pay. The bank, the bosses, we'll have them. But that's the only thing he said. And I guess he had kind of made it known he was pissed off that he was not getting paid all that well. But, honestly, it seems to be kind of a national pastime in France is to gripe about what you're getting paid for. So maybe that wasn't seen as a clear indicator he was about to make off with $17 million.
So the moral then seems to be that you should probably pay your security guards a little more, or at least treat them better. Maybe some perks or something.
You
think that would be common sense, though, to entrust your employee with that much of your money. You would pay them well to, keep them happy.
Yeah, but it also speaks to a larger issue, too. I think, there's been a lot of people in governmental capacities or everywhere that are looking at white-collar crime, and for something like stealing money or, that type of stuff from your corporation or from a bank or whatever, as a white-collar criminal rather than running off with a money truck, then you do the same thing. You might even do less time.
Right.
So,
yeah.
If there's no new legislation or regulations to kind of increase the penalties that people like that can face, then you're in a MetLife prison, and then you come out and you're $10 million richer. And
yeah, I would imagine this guy probably has some CEO that he knows of, or that's particularly incensed him that he knows that guy's got $100 billion that he bilked from whatever company.
Yeah.
So why shouldn't I take a truck full of $17 million?
Well, that seems to be
heroes in this case.
Right. Well, that seems to be kind of a bit of what's spurring the whole hero worship of this guy in France, because a lot of people are thinking that, a lot of investment bankers and the Wall Street folks who created the great big crash last year and all that sort of thing. These people have lost, other just cases of outright fraud have stolen well more than this. Are getting off, maybe not even being charged. People who crashed the whole economic system aren't being charged for anything. Some of them just lost their jobs, and that's, some of them are still doing what they're doing and being paid very, very handsomely for it. And I think that really fuels a huge amount of frustration amongst the average folks on the street in France. So it's kind of a unusual situation. But it seems to also play to a larger just sort of sense of criminal worship going on over in France, because the articles I've read have indicated that, this is it's not uncommon for French people to really go nuts when some criminal like this sort of gets away with a crime and is seen as being clever. I mean, the French really like the fact that he did this without hurting anybody and just basically had the gumption just to drive off with,
But that's not unique to France. I mean, American pop culture is based on hero worship of gangsters of all kinds. I mean, Scarface is a really popular movie, and that's not about, a guy who's really nice to kids on Christmas and stuff.
But yeah, that wasn't even real, too. I mean, you talk about like Jesse James and Bonnie and Clyde and all that stuff.
Yeah, right. All those guys. So. Yeah, I mean, Jesse James particularly was a superhero back in the – Dillinger was another one.
Yeah, right.
The old school gangsters. I mean, we don't have those type of gangsters now, I guess, because it's – they steal – those. They were only stealing a few $1,000. Bank robberies don't really –
Well, nowadays you've got to have rocks. I mean, nowadays you've got to have rocks in your head to steal a bank in the United States. I mean, the average bank robbery. We were talking about this the other day, actually. Is you know the average bank robbery, I guess, in the U.S. nets you about $3,000, right? Because you clear out the drawers and you're out of there.
And you go to jail for like 20 years. It's
offense. And the feds have like a more than 90% chance of catching you. And not least which because you always hear stories of these guys, they do something stupid, like they leave behind their wallet or a business card or, you know, just some other device basically says, catch me, please, I have your money, you know, it's very, very strange.
But I used to live out in Jamaica, Queens, where I used to go to school at St. John's University, and we'd read, like, the Daily News and stuff, and it would seem like every day, or at least, like, 3 times a week, there'd be a bank robbery, like, just in Queens, in the area.
Really?
And so there was something, I'm sure most of these people end up getting caught, but most of the times you'd hear about it, it would be successful, you know, for that night or whatever, that day. So, I mean, you can't – I was kind of always
it
like,
depends on how
hey, it's pretty easy to steal a bank, rob a bank. I mean,
I'm sure when you're stealing a bank, if you're robbing a bank, it's not like –
stealing a bank.
Picking up the bank and jacking it up on a
– walk off of the building.
When you're robbing a bank, I'm sure the tellers are instructed to really just give you what you want and get out. I mean, safety is usually number one because the ability to catch the – bank robber later is so high, I guess, so easy to do that. They're like, take it. We'll get you in a minute.
It's usually FDIC insured. And
that's true.
So.
Right. Yeah, right. So, you know, but bank robberies just sort of strike me as one of those things where, you know, a lot of bad guys know, they know it's insured, right? So they figure it's, you know, a victimless crime, right? They know that people aren't supposed to resist, so they're probably not going to get shot while doing it. You know, and they figure, well, they can just walk in, not even have a gun, just put in a slip, say, give me the money, and they get it. It strikes me as one of those crimes that probably anybody could get away with if they only did it once. But the thing is, if you're going to be the kind of person who's going to go and rob a bank, right? If you're not going to put your brain power to an honest living, you're never going to stop with just one bank. You're going to keep doing it because you can think you can do it every time.
It's like Lay's potato chips.
You can't steal just one.
You can't steal just one.
And as we learned from Pulp Fiction, though, if you want to go to a diner, that's probably the way to go. You get more money from the customers walking in the wallets than you do from the teller.
Exactly. Emily wouldn't know because she's allergic
Emily
to movies.
Emily doesn't like to watch movies.
Emily, have you seen Pulp Fiction?
Yeah, I have, but it was like when it first came out.
Why do you have to lie on this podcast? Why do you have to make this podcast
dental lies?
I don't
remember what he was talking about.
Just so we know, because we make 1,000 references to this, because we're fascinated by the fact that Emily does not watch movies, only documentaries.
Documentaries,
so
man.
Probably a reference it more than once. So now you're in. You're on the in of our in joke, I guess.
Well, you know, one last thing I just want to bring up about this whole Tony Muselin caper is that, you know, getting back to...
That's his name?
Yeah, Tony Muselin.
Okay.
Which sounds a little... I don't know.
Tony Cereal.
Yeah, exactly. but what was strange is that, you know, he obviously came up about $400,000 to buy a really nice Ferrari and to have a ton of money in the bank afterwards. So it would seem that he had been stealing from somebody beforehand.
It would seem their screening process may have been a little flawed. Regardless, this is not like some guy who just was like the model employee one day, most likely.
And who just snapped and just drove off
unless
with the mountain of cash.
Unless he legitimately had a side job that nobody knew about, and he was really good at betting horses.
Apparently he was just a quiet guy. He did his job, went home, he would weightlift. He would lift weights, and then he didn't really do a whole lot. But, I mean, he had most of the money stored in a storage unit that he had rented under an assumed name. And like I said, he had cleaned out his personal finances before he actually took off and went to Monaco. So, I mean, he actually had the whole thing planned out. It seems like maybe he had been stealing all along, you know, or something, you know, because, I mean, the authorities are not saying he was under investigation for any other crimes. I got to wonder, was he slowly just taking the little bits here and there over a long period of time to kind of test the defenses of
who would ever do that?
Huh?
Who would ever do that from their company?
No one.
Why would he turn himself in then? If this was like one of these plans that
that's what
think
I'm baffled
go on for
by.
Years, I don't know. You know, when he's like,
he was on his way to becoming the French DP Cooper, right? I mean, they had no clue where he was, and actually there was a big, you know, the French alerted Interpol because they were just because they were really worried that if he was going to go to the Balkans, and once he got there, they would never see him again. You know, and once he went into the hills of Serbia or something, they were never going to find this guy. So I don't know. Maybe he thought he was going to get caught and left a lot of the money behind, and maybe he only planned on keeping $3.5 million. Who knows? Maybe he just had a mental breakdown. There's no way of knowing. I mean, when he gave himself up in Monaco, the authorities said he appeared confused,
right.
And they weren't even sure if he knew where he was. So who knows
what
maybe he just went on a bender for 3 days and just walked in all hopped up on absinthe and just said, you know what, ain't worth it, turning myself in, who knows.
Well, either way, watch your employees, they're all thieves. That's my advice.
Morgan especially.
Oh, please.
It's like, well, I only took the Post-its.
I'm going to steal these microphones when Bill's not looking.
It's our last podcast.
Yeah, right. Cool. All right, so we're going to wrap up the segment real quick, take a short break, and we'll be right back with more news and insight in the world of risk management. Be right back. Okay, and we're back. Jared, what do you got for us?
Well, today, I believe it was today, the pirates from Somalia, they, for the second time, attacked the Maersk, Alabama, for the first time they were unsuccessful. This time they were again unsuccessful because the ship used what is termed a sonic blaster.
Sonic blaster.
Yes, a long-range acoustic device, as well as small arms fire to scare them off. Basically what it is a loud sound-making device that as soon as you hear it, you don't want to be around. And they ran off.
So this is the same ship that was attacked. And we have this in the upcoming December issue where we cover some of the risk issues of the past year. But this is the same ship that was attacked early in the year. And they didn't we send Navy SEALs in to kill them?
Yes.
Kill some pirates?
Obama promptly got elected and then declared war against the pirates and killed and had Navy SEALs snipe the pirates.
Yeah, right. But they held the captain of that ship hostage for 5 days on a lifeboat at gunpoint. Until the Navy SEALs
on a lifeboat?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
For 5 days until the Navy SEALs, sharpshooters arrived and killed the three.
The first go around, the pirates stormed the boat, and the crew locked themselves in the engine room where they disabled the ship, and so the captain couldn't drive or to steer it. Then at that point they apparently jumped out, beat the crap out of one pirate, took him hostage. The rest of the pirates then took the captain hostage, and there's a little back and forth. Who are they going to get back? And I guess the pirate said, "Give us back our guy. We'll give you the captain." Pirates did. Pirates said, "Ha ha!" Like very James Bond. You know, we were lying. And then went to an away boat where they're there for like a day. That ran out of gas, and then they shipped everything to a lifeboat, set the Alabama adrift, and then were trying to get back to the shore where they could then, I guess,
ransom the pirate.
Ransom the captain. That's when the Navy showed up and gave them all high distance or high speed long distance lead poisoning.
Long distance lead. So then the pirates come back and attack the same ship. What, 6 months later?
Yes, unbeknownst to them, I believe.
Well, I would hope so.
Yes. They've got a bad history of attacking the wrong ship. Didn't they hit some French warship a little while ago?
They did, yes. Again, unsuccessfully. Yeah.
So basically, the pirates are just seeing ships go by. Well, they also just recently, didn't they? I think they still are captive. So people are just in the area on a yacht.
Yeah.
They just kidnap them. So it's basically what it is any boat off the coast of Somalia
that they can see.
That they can see, they'll attack regardless of whether or not it's a warship or a ship that already has been proven to be the death of them.
A married couple sailboat. It doesn't matter.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. Because they can hold these people hostage and get money from,
Well, saying the coast of Somalia actually doesn't even seem to be much of an accurate indicator anymore, because it used to be, for a long time, I guess, they'd say stay away from like 100 nautical miles of the coast, and then it was 200 nautical miles. Now it's pretty much anywhere between the coast of Africa and the Maldives Islands.
Right.
Gulf of Aden, is that what it's
called? Yeah, I mean, there's a huge amount of territory of water. These guys are doing like deep water, or they call blue water, attacks. And
well, you got to see that. I mean, it's interesting that obviously the Maersk, Alabama, was prepared this time.
Yes, it wasn't last time.
They had like a military force or armed force on board, along with the
Private contractors.
Yes.
Yeah, along with the sonic blaster.
Yeah, they had small arms,
cool, which sounds just really cool. I mean,
and you know now
it's better than shooting them, but how?
I'm imagining this great
imagine
big
how loud a sonic blaster is that it's going to turn you away.
Where do you get one of those?
Where do you get one? I just have images of like this massive like Death Stars type radio dish on the bow, just sort of like. Just aiming at these guys or
have
something.
Have you heard of like the the stuff that I think stores were using. There's like tones that only teenagers can use.
Yeah, the ultrasonic things.
Because it hits a certain frequency.
Yeah.
And I've heard on the computer, and I've actually played it, and so far my hearing is held up enough that I can actually hear it.
Yeah.
But I've heard that like in certain malls, they'll play the stuff like in the like the entryway where kids might be congregating.
To deter loitering, right?
Right. Yeah. Which
really?
Also probably deters any younger employees from working in the perfume section, say. But
yeah, true.
Still, I can imagine the sonic blaster is not just some high-pitched squeal that annoys it's only a pirate's hearing frequency. But hey, it's got to be crazy. Something a lot more intense.
All I know is that walking down the streets of Manhattan when an ambulance or a fire truck rolls by and they got their sirens going, I mean, it is ear-splitting. It's really loud. I can only imagine if you had a cannon specifically designed to focus sound on your head, just how uncomfortable it would be. You're sitting there trying to drive a high-speed boat towards some freight ship, and the guys on top are already shooting bullets at you, and then they hit you with this sound thing. I'd be like, you know what? I'll do it tomorrow.
I wonder how much of those things cost, and if it's feasible for any ship to start running around with them.
Yeah, as the Wired blog says on it, says sometimes the combination of the LRAD, which is the sonic boom making thing, fire hoses and evasive maneuvers is not enough. So sometimes you need the extra small arms and
need some guns.
And
we can't think it's the only thing that would deter anybody. Sure.
Right. And one of the pirate bosses, a guy known as Red Teeth.
Oh, Red Teeth.
Thank you.
Because he never brushed, ever.
Or just because his normal name of Clarence isn't scary enough,
No, well, Tony Longbutter is a more scary name than that.
Tony Longbutter.
Just random names we like to throw out there.
So what about Red Teeth? He's reporting that four of his colleagues were killed or injured.
During the second attack,
yeah, which was not sure. He's not suing, but he is.
He's really pissed.
Was quoted in the New York Times as saying, "We will keep attacking on foreign vessels until illegal fishing and toxic dump is stopped."
So they're doing this as a pirate form of like a Greenpiece.
No, that's just one of their.
It seems to be that's what he is proposing. I think they're more in it for the money.
Yeah, I would think so too.
Well, there's been a lot of things I've read that basically, since the collapse of the Somali government, what's happened is that. There's been no national body there to challenge international fishing and toxic waste dumping off the coast of the country. It's been kind of a free-for-all zone. So, I mean, most international fishing trawlers, when they're operating within national waters, either can't or they have very strict fishing quotas enforced by the country, and the country can always take it to the United Nations if it's not locally enforceable.
Right.
Somalia has no such recourse, and my understanding is that it's been 17 years without a central government. That the local fishing grounds have been decimated by large scale international trawlers, and so I have read on a couple different blogs and that sort of thing that I'm not condoning piracy necessarily, but there is at least some sentiment out there that some of the pirates are basically just people who just they can't get a job otherwise. Now, having said that, it's kind of like saying, well,
Yeah, but it's similar.
I peddle crack because I live in a bad neighborhood and I can't get a decent job. I mean, there's no justification there either.
In Nigeria with the oil fields when other international companies come in and take your natural resources.
Oh, yeah.
It kind of pisses you off.
Yeah, sure.
I would imagine it's the same as our bank robber fellow who saw other people getting paid when he wasn't in the same working for the same company. It's just I guess it's really the difference is the means to which you go to make to right that supposed wrong.
Well, having said all that, I would imagine that if something were to happen and miraculously Somalia guys act together tomorrow and a whole new government were to come around, right, and there was complete enforceability of its fishing grounds,
I don't think it would change.
I really don't think the pirates would all go, hooray, we can go back to fishing, because they're making so much more money as pirates now. I mean, there's no incentive for them to stop being pirates.
The
piracy industry is huge.
No, I know, but how much?
They're driving SUVs around there. There's internet cafes.
Well,
and there used to be nothing.
I was talking to a fellow who runs the Ocean Marine unit for Swiss Re just this week, and he said that it's kind of hard to gauge the total amount of money the piracy industry in Somalia is generating because a lot of shipping companies don't report their losses. But there are recent cases where ships are being successfully ransomed for like $3.5 million, mm-hmm. and that's for the ship, its contents, and the crew. And we're talking cash drops. They figure out these contrived ways to drop money out of an airplane, hire a French armored car guy to drive it from Serbia, who knows.
I imagine there's a larger conglomerate of people that this is going to, but if you actually look at – we have a photo in the upcoming issue of one of these boats that engages in the attacks, and they're really small, and there's not that many people involved in the actual attack.
No, it's not
comparatively to how much
the
money they're
very
taking
impressive.
In.
It looks like just a regular outboard motor and like something you'd go to for a weekend fishing trip on the lake.
Yeah,
I mean with the equipment is nothing special. This one photo's got like you know, a ladder you use to paint
made
the house.
Made of twigs and twine.
You know, and like and some milk crates that they're sitting on, and it's not a big operation. So somebody, I don't know who's getting the money. It's
and because, I mean, traditionally, I think a little more, some ships are going to the small arms and contractors on board for security purposes, but generally they haven't done that for the past few years, so they don't even need that much of an arsenal, you know, one RPG and a couple of machine guns. And
which is Somalia, about really $5 supposed... a piece. I mean, it's so easy to get armed to that degree, right?
I don't think they were really supposed to. I don't think there was allowed, or rather, most shipping are not allowed to have arms on board, but I don't have no bearing to back that up.
I believe you're right.
Well, there's a difference between arming a ship, say, like mounting weaponry, like a flak cannon or something on the deck of your boat, and having small arms. I mean, most ships have small arm lockers because when you're in international waters, there's no gun laws to restrict you, right? You need something to protect yourself. But, I mean, you know, for a lot of ships, they don't like to carry weapons or even engage pirates like this because it just encourages violence. I mean, if you shoot on the pirates, they're not going to, you know, typically run away. I mean, I imagine there's some sustained gunfire between these guys and the Alabama crew, right? I mean... So,
did the guy from Swiss Re have anything to say about that too? Because you know, I've read certain articles where some of that is influenced by insurance purposes. Why there isn't more ships arming themselves?
Yeah, his name is Tony Cowie, and he really knew a whole lot about the whole thing. And really, what he said is, you know, he wasn't talking about, you know, the use of crews to, you know, security teams to deter it, really. But he was just more looking at it from the point of view of, you know, the ransoming and just. Well, one of the things he mentioned, which I thought was pretty fascinating, is the fact that, you know, given how far Somali pirates are now operating in deep blue water, right? They're so far off the coast now, to avoid them entirely is really not feasible, because that section of African coastline is basically a major, major world trade route. And if you're going to avoid it entirely, you've got to go so far out of your way.
You've got to go around the tip of Africa.
Right. You've got to cut through like the heart of the Indian Ocean. It's going to add massive cost to the shipping, to shipping companies, and add extra time and all that sort of thing. So it's a problem that has to be addressed. And really, his notion was, I mean, you know, a security team is a tactical solution, but really – The solution is Somalia has to get a government back, you know, and right now the country's fragmenting. It's got autonomous zones and Islamist insurgents and Mogadishu and all that craziness. So,
and this is obviously having a huge impact on insurance rates. I did an article for Risk Management Magazine in the January-February 2009 issue about this same topic, and it's I was interviewing somebody, I think it was from Lords of London maybe, that, you know, stated the fact that shipping insurance rates had skyrocketed from about, you know, $500 if you're sailing through the Gulf of Aden in 2007 to about $20,000 in 2008 just to take that same route. So it's really hurting companies and then, you know, hurting the consumers too, because we
and any ship that does get, you know, captured or delayed some way, you know, that's screwing up cargo lines and supply chains for everyone, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well, I mean, certainly if you look at like those big container ships, I mean, the total insurable value of those things is just astronomical. I mean, you've got like $1 billion, you know, vessels cruising through the water when you consider the contents and the hull.
They're really
cost.
Not even capturing the stuff to do anything with the cargo. The cargo's
no, they don't want anything
there.
To do with it.
It's just the ransom of the ship and its crew.
Well, the other thing that Cowie said was pretty interesting is how, I mean, what you see in Somalia, it really is true piracy, which is, you know, what we think of, you know, traditionally as, you know, an armed group actually attacks and takes over a ship. You know, for years and years, there were still incidences that were counting as piracy, but typically it was more like people would get on board the ship and they would just rob the crew, right? They would actually, you know, take their personal effects. They'd take stereos out of the cabin. They'd take your wallet. You know, that's where they just sort of steal petty cash off
like
the boat.
It's like a ship mugging.
Yeah, right. It would be like a ship mugging, and they just clean you out that way, and then you go on your way. But they wouldn't even try to crack into the cargo or take the ship because they didn't have the means. They didn't have... I mean, where are you gonna dump a great big boat? You know, I mean, they just didn't have the ability to do it. But the situation in Somalia has created this perfect kind of set of conditions. You know, and apparently it's not the first time in history that Somalia has been a hotbed of piracy. It's just one of those places where the local geography and this trade routes just kind of makes this perfect opportunity for shipping to be easily disrupted in the area. So it seems like there's nothing good coming out of it anytime soon. So
it'll be interesting to see too, as, you know, we move towards a more globalized society, or, you know, already have, and these economic interests kind of coincide with these political risk angles. Whereas, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, this would be something, you know, UN and all these NGOs might take up as a cause to, you know, intervene and try to fix the Somalia situation. Now, you know, it'll be interesting to see how much maybe global corporate organizations get involved in this, and they're like, well, this is really screwing with our business, so we need to, you know, try to get some sort of activism that way.
Yeah.
Well, at the very least, if you're running a ship through there, you own the shipping company, you might be in your best interest to have these, have measures in, have security forces, and have, you know, cannons and what have you. It's not something you necessarily had to lay out that sort of cost, but now maybe it is because it's pretty, you know, if it cuts into your bottom line, that's usually where you get things moving pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly something that's going to bear, you know, watching a whole lot more. I mean, I know we talked about piracy stuff in our last podcast, and not that we want to beat the topic into the ground, but the last thing I wanted to leave you guys with is something when I spoke to Swiss Re earlier this week, and that there actually is kind of like a piracy season. Like, what's happening is that in this part of the world, the monsoon season is coming to an end. So as it comes to an end, we're going to have 6 months of relatively calm weather in these waters. So when that happens, we can expect to see piracy attacks really increase in number. Mm-hmm. So we're probably going to see a lot more of it in the news. And even there, I mean, every major nation has got like warships in the area. China, India, yeah. United States, the European Union. I mean, they're all, Russia's got assets in the area. They're all trying to patrol, and they just can't, even still, the area is so vast, like, you just can't stop at all, so.
Yeah, and they have drones flying overhead, too, but as you said, it's just too big of an area to patrol.
Yeah,
every inch of it.
Well, I mean, you know, the area that's getting hit most often is itself the size of a pretty sizable nation, you know, so, I mean, it just, and these boats are so tiny, it's not like you have massive galleons, yeah, right, just sailing along. Oh, that's clearly
pirate. Johnny Depp at the helm, you know, it's not really
pirate armada. Yeah, right, it's the worst pirate I've ever seen. But it is refreshing to know that we actually have a legitimate pirate name now, though. We got Red Teeth. That's so
Red Teeth.
Red Teeth is the new patron saint of Somali piracy. It's the new Blackbeard.
new Blackbeard. Love it. All right, we're going to take a quick break and come back again with more news and good stuff. Be right back. Okay, and we're back. Next up, Morgan, you got something to share with us about what?
Sure.
Hollywood?
Hollywood. In my, I really love the, I love watching Hollywood and watch it shoot itself in the foot as new media comes along and it can't seem to adjust and does things more and more to alienate its customers and lose revenue and doesn't seem to know what to do. And I kind of like watching a death spiral of an entire industry. It's sort of amusing,
so,
I guess.
So says the guy in the print media business.
Yeah, I know.
But anyway, carry on.
It's amusing from the rubbernecking standpoint, and it's thankfully not, you know, about print media. So, yeah. Okay. But evidently, Hollywood is losing money hand over fist on CDs and DVD sales because, well, probably for a few reasons. One, most of the material that people are supposed to buy is terrible, I'm sure. Two, people like to rent the stuff because most likely it's terrible. I mean, and you know, you have things like Netflix and Redbox. Redbox are those.
What is Redbox?
Those are supermarket. Well, you see them in supermarkets and convenience stores. It's like the kiosks where you can get like a movie for like $1, like $1 a night, and just rent it at the supermarket.
Sounds like a Coke machine for movies.
Basically,
they're like 7-Eleven, don't they?
Yeah, I just saw them in this. There was like a 7-Eleven by me just had one. I thought it was a Coke machine until I got closer and put my glasses on.
I can't drink this.
And it wasn't Coke that came out.
Really? What is this? Is knowing this doesn't taste good at all.
It's so thirsty. Yeah.
But anyway, that's sort of where the big money is. I mean, where people's movie interest at least have come. So Hollywood has just a great idea of saying, I guess the movie studios were like, well, we're losing money to Netflix. People are not renting our brilliant DVDs, so we need to figure out a way that we can bring up our revenue. So why don't we do this? Why don't we take a 30-day window from the release of the DVD until the time that anyone can actually rent it. So there's going to be a whole month where the only way you can get these movies is to purchase the DVD. Now, as I forgot to mention there, the other big problem is piracy, of course.
Right.
We're not talking about the high seas piracy. We're talking about the digital piracy in this case. Everything seems to have a tie right now.
Yeah, right.
Crime to piracy.
To larceny.
So what they're basically saying, as far as I can tell, is you've got a problem with piracy and you've got a problem with products that people aren't really that keen on buying. And you're basically saying, it's available in the world, folks, but you can't have it unless you pay $30 for it, which I think is just an invitation to go, well, why don't you just go pirate it?
Yeah.
I think it more or less Hollywood is basically opening up a window where they're just telling people, more or less inviting people to pirate their movies.
Yeah, it's going to have the opposite effect.
I mean, if you think about it, if you're a consumer of DVDs, you're used to getting them on their release date, and particularly if you're used to getting them from, you know, internet-based channels, say Netflix or iTunes or what have you, you're already kind of used to doing things online when it comes to movies. is it really going to be that far of a step for you to take to just go, well, if you're not going to give me what I want, I'm just going to go take it for free?
Yeah.
The other trick is Netflix is actually going to sign on to this, most likely, which seems weird, but probably because they're going to get discounts on the movies to start with. But I would think this is the type of thing that kind of shoots Netflix business a little bit, too.
Probably. Yeah.
You know, why would you now rent a movie that if you're inviting people to pirate some for 30 days because they can't get it any other way except for buying it?
Of course, it may not be bothering them that much because I think Netflix seems to be getting a whole lot of traction off of folks who have kind of given up on going to the movie theaters in general and figure, you know what, you know, there's a movie I want to watch. Okay, especially since the time between theatrical release and DVD release seems to be getting shorter now. I remember It used to be on average about 6 months. Now it seems to be maybe as short as 4 months for some movies.
Well, a lot of Netflix sales.
You know, what's another 30 days of waiting?
Netflix primary sales are driven by like older stuff. You know, when I was on Netflix for a while, I watched all the old Hitchcock movies I never watched.
Oh, sure. Okay.
So that's what most people are. I mean, that's, I guess, the vast majority of their catalog is going to be back catalog stuff. But What gets people in the door, I mean, is the new stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I used to go to, I'm sure you will remember going to like the video store, and the first thing you do in a video store is go to the new releases, and then maybe you backtrack to like, oh, there's nothing new I want to see, let's go see something else. It just doesn't seem right to go, well, this, let's not just disregard this whole part of our business and like, you know, not sell it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that the movie studios have always done the best job in kind of protecting their inventory, but I mean, I sympathize with their situation because, you know, the way the financial model of that whole industry works is that, you know, you have a huge amount of money you invest in any given movie, right? And most movies don't really turn a profit. I mean, the big blockbuster ends up floating the cost for, what, 9 or 10 failed projects. Right. And DVD sales have often been what turns a movie that's either marginally profitable or unprofitable into the black, you know? You know, there's some movies that are kind of, you know, famous, you know, box office failures, right? Either just critically, they just flopped, or they just weren't able to recoup their lavish production costs. And it was always the DVD sales that ultimately turned things around for them. So I can see why they want to kind of protect that revenue stream. But, you know, at the same time, I mean, you've got to be smart about it, you know, and alienating your customer base, right, especially a customer base that can learn how to pick up stuff off a torrent so easily. Why push them to that?
It's really what they're doing is holding on to an old model.
Yeah.
Holding on to the old way of doing things. The old way of doing things is we make a movie, then we sell this movie on DVD, and maybe we rent it and we do it. But if that way is not working, you've got an entire group of people, you know, your customers. It's the whole idea lately of, you know, if it's internet-based, let's not give the customer what they want.
Right.
Which is killing a lot of things that are not willing to progress with the times. The internet is here. Sorry. It's happening. You need to change with it because it's not going to go away just because you don't like it. And you're going to hold your breath until, you know, things change. Because when they change, you'll find out that you're left standing outside poor.
Right. And I think it's just going away from, too, they expect to be able to continue this ownership model. Whereas I will pay $20 to have a physical copy of said movie or even, you know, music if you want to go there, and just so I can have it in my house and listen to it anytime I want. Well, that's not really necessary anymore. Like, for instance, I just went this weekend to Ohio for my old roommate's wedding, and he happened to have a booklet of like 50 of my CDs, and a lot of more great CDs and he's had them for 5 years. He moved away, and I left them in his car or whatever. And I got them all back, and I was like, oh, this is awesome. But then I was like, I've actually like kind of reacquired these somehow in different ways, or like some of these songs that I really like I can just listen to them on YouTube, and you know, there's not the need to own them. Whereas if I would have lost 50 CDs like 15 years ago, it would have been like
catastrophic.
I would have never been able to hear that music again. Now it's not, I don't need to own it as much as I would have in the past. And I feel like the same way for movies. Like, I own a lot of movies, but I don't watch them all that often. And I'm cool to be able to just get it on Netflix, you know, download.
There's so many choices. I mean, everybody's got it on demand. If you've got cable, you've got on demand options. If you've got you can even purchase movies on demand. You know, not just talking about free stuff that's just playing on your everyday cable. You have to get lucky and turn it on and see it. And you know, everybody can record. DVR is a pretty common. You know,
yeah,
it's not just
absolutely.
TiVo was the little thing. Now every single cable system has got a DVR option. And sure, you might have to pay $10 a month or something like that. But I personally have access to more movies with the click of a button than I ever did.
Yeah.
There is never going to be a time I can see – I was never that type of person to go buy DVDs anyway – that I'm going to go out and buy a DVD regardless. But if there was something I really wanted to see and you're not giving it to me, like I said, there's other ways.
Yeah, and I don't get the 30-day window. Like, I don't watch a lot of movies, but if there is one that just came out on DVD that I really wanted to see, I'm not going to be dying to buy it. I'll wait 30 days, get it, you know,
and
from
not only
Netflix
that, think about this. The movie's out for 30 days. How long does the buzz last for a movie that everybody's got to see? A month goes by, there's something else that's out now.
Yeah, right.
And I have a feeling you just might lose those sales altogether. There's so many movies that will come out and go, oh, I'd like to see that. And then life happens, you forget. And
yeah,
the next thing you know, it's not in the theaters and you don't miss it because, well, it's just a movie.
We are getting a little old, though. We got to remember that, too. I mean, they are making most of their money off 13 to 25-year-olds who do have that social pressure of their friends that if they haven't seen The Hangover yet and it's still 6 months on, then they're kind of a loser.
Well, that's yeah, right. If they're worried about that demographic, then that demographic is probably more apt to download something and
absolutely
steal it and pirate it than any others. I mean, the only people are the people that have enough money to purchase things. If the people, you're the consumers you got to groom are the people who don't have any money, the kids, depending on mom and dad's allowance or maybe, you know, part-time job, you alienate them from the start.
Yeah.
Well, good luck having that industry last very long. I mean, it's only going to be so long before, you know, their parents stop buying them. I have DVDs I bought a year ago that I've never opened. They're still in the plastic.
Yeah.
It seems to be an outdated business model. Is it only one studio or is it like it's all
The article I looked at didn't say. I mean, it kept using Hollywood, and I'm sure it's more than one studio because really it would make sense that they'd all have to kind of come together to make that window happen. It's sort of just out of touch
Well, you're saying something about the Sony and the Bravia TV, right?
Well, the thing is, too, is even while at the same time they're doing things that are dumb, then they try to get involved with things like, let's see if we can be innovative for a second and do something that kind of ties everything together. Maybe we can, you know, be unique, but it turns out to be stupid. For instance, Sony's got a $1,000 Bravia television for sale, HD, Blu-ray, all that bit, right?
Which does look really good, by the way. I looked at it the other day. No, the picture is
sweet. Hey, listen, there's nothing wrong with a nice big TV, nice big flat screen TV with all the high definition.
Sony makes a good
bells
TV.
And whistles. But their idea, I guess, a little promo idea was that they were going to offer, if you bought this television, you'd get the opportunity to rent the movie Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. It was a 3D kids movie cartoon back in the summer.
My kids never fail to remind me about it every day.
You'd get to rent that movie, remember, being the operative word, for the low, low price of $24.95.
What?
30 days in advance of its release.
That is stupid tax.
Which just seems like you just wasted your breath writing that you know, advertisement, because I can't see anybody but the least informed consumer actually doing that.
The only group I could see them thinking this would work with would be, frankly, groups like my family.
Parents.
We don't really go to the theater all that often. We do have like kind of movie night at home, because once you have a Blu-ray player and a nice TV set, turn off the lights, you kind of get home. Yeah, exactly. So maybe they're kind of banking, well, you know, you'd pay $40 to go out to the theater for tickets for everybody and for snacks, that sort of thing. Well, then what's $25 just to do it at home?
But $25 just seems like a weird price point for that. Like, wouldn't you want to, you know, I can understand they said rent it for $5, rent it for $10.
Yeah, right.
Not rent it for the cost of what the DVD's going to sell for when it finally does come out, which we're going to make you buy again, by the way, because renting, this is only a rental. This is not a purchase.
Well, you know, circling back to something that Jared brought up, which I thought was a really fascinating point, which is the notion of this shift in perceived value from the actual physical thing you can hang on to. I mean, I remember you'd hold on to a CD and you go, okay, this is $15 right here, right? But it's the value proposition is no longer hanging on to physical material, but having access to intellectual property, really, right? And if you're looking at it like that, then Hollywood has completely failed to pick up on the lesson that the music industry learned when they went, all right, you know what? They adopted the iTunes model. Let's sell a song for $1. I mean, yeah, all right, it may have cost you $100 million to produce, I don't know, Transformers 2 or something, right? But the truth is, that however much the movie costs to make has no bearing on how much the consumer is willing to pay to get access to it. Okay, if you want to pay $5 for a movie, you're going to pay $5 for a movie, or you're going to download it for free. It doesn't matter if the movie was a $10,000, you know, thing like Paranormal Activity, or a gold covered, you know, extravagant project like Transformers 2. People are going to pay for it what they feel they want to pay for it.
Right.
And
Transformers 2 is not worth $5. Just let you know that.
Frankly, neither is Paranormal Activity, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah. So, well, you know, and frankly, the whole thing, this whole situation would solve itself if Hollywood just got back to making decent movies, frankly. I mean, that's a whole other podcast.
If you gave people the intrinsic value, come on, Transformers 2 is probably a terrible movie from all accounts. All reviews have said it's terrible, and they spent a lot of money, and they made a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But those people, I think that, you know, the box office draw, that's just from the special effects, you know, experience. And as no, and as big as your television may get in your house, it's not the same as being in the movie theater. So then you start to notice that the plot is abysmal, and you're never going to want to watch it again.
Yeah.
I mean, after that, if you got nothing to sell me, essentially, except for some CGI that I could probably do if I took some courses.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, it's more complicated than that.
yeah. You know, it's actually not that much more complicated. There's a movie floating around YouTube right now. It's called like the White Box or something like that. And pretty much it's just this 9-minute sci-fi clip. It's kind of first person action, kind of like Cloverfield or something like that. And it's just basically just this little short story of some guy. It's obviously shot like in the Netherlands or something like that. And the idea is some guy's in a lab. He grabs this little cube, hits a button on it, and starts his chain reaction. Outside, you see this wormhole crate in the sky, and he's being chased by these guys in powered armor. It's this big science fiction action spectacle, right? And it's a really cool 9-minute film. I mean, you look at the special effects, they're not as sophisticated as you'd see in, say, a Hollywood blockbuster, but, I mean, they're really, really good, okay? And what happened is this guy made this movie for, like, 130 euros and buying his friends a pizza. I mean, he made it on virtually nothing. And now Hollywood's knocking on his door going, hey, you want to do some stuff for us? I mean, the cost to produce these things can be very, very low, you know, and so Hollywood really needs to reevaluate, you know, from a terms of, you know, just return on investment. You know, is there a smarter way for them to be making the profits they need to make?
Well, I think you had said this in relation to music, and I mean, I don't know how it relates to movies, but with a lot of this intellectual property that has now got a huge digital component, maybe the selling of that recording, if it's music, is not your key selling point anymore. I mean, maybe you just kind of let it go after a certain point, and, you know, musicians make money on concerts and T-shirts.
Yeah, right.
Movies make money on the box office. People are still going to want to go and sit in the dark with a bunch of friends and have that communal experience on the giant screen.
Right.
And especially if you have IMAX screens and 3D movies, that's adding value to the movie experience, which is something that you can't get at home without spending an arm and a leg to do so.
Absolutely true. And maybe Universal looks at it as like, and they buy a popcorn manufacturer, and they get into that game, and they buy these theaters from Lowe's or whatnot. I mean, we live in New York, so if you go to the theaters around here, they're really, really nice. I mean, it's impressive to go if you're going to go see some garbage like Transformers 2. That's where you want to see it.
Sound,
but I mean,
system and,
I know smaller cities throughout the nation maybe don't have those beautiful theaters with the great leather seats and the amazing sound.
A lot of them have got some really nice, like, Cineplexes, though.
I'm sure they do, but I'm just saying, like, you know, if
you have to run into a small... I have one right in my neighborhood that's a small little rinky-dink place with busted seats and stuff. You know, second-run movies and things.
Like, you can make these things in, like, palaces, you know, like symphonies or whatever, you know, type of stadiums that if someone wanted to get into that game and try to expand on that, then maybe that's the way to go. And instead of trying to put the brakes on this old model and try to just, you know, wring every last penny out of this sponge... that's this outdated model. I mean, I look at things even like Blu-ray, and I'm like, yeah, that'll be gone in 3 years. I'm not buying one. You know, like,
yeah, right.
Yeah,
there's no way that's going to stick around.
So quickly, there really is. There's no telling that you know, I mean, in my lifetime, it went. There was laser discs at one point, and then VHS and beta was a problem, or, you know, like.
But when we already
have a lot of formats that have gone through, and I'm only in my mid-30s. I've already seen six formats for movies.
You raised a really good point. Blu-ray straight up killed my family buying movies anymore because we had an extensive DVD collection, right? And even though the Blu-ray player is backwards compatible, it can play DVDs. I mean, honestly, the picture really is that much better on a Blu-ray player versus a DVD player. We resisted it for like a year and a half or whatever. And one day we just walked in the TV store and we were just like, we saw a Blu-ray picture and we were just thunderstruck at how good
really nice.
It's really nice how good it looks, okay? So when we got and we had the Blu-ray player, but we realized, you know what? I am not going to go back and rebuy every movie I own on Blu-ray just to get the better picture, okay? If I need to see it that badly, I'll just Netflix it. It's okay. I mean, I'm already used to watching movies on my iPod, which has got a screen the size of a postage stamp.
Yeah.
They're not going to, good luck trying to get me to pony up hundreds of dollars to rebuy movies I've already bought two or sometimes even three times. I mean, come on. How many times do I have to buy Pulp Fiction until I can just say, fine, I'm done. You know, I own it. Just leave me alone.
These are not consumers in a vacuum because these consumers went through this with music, you know, and rebought their collections off a record, then cassette, then CD, and whatever comes next.
Yeah.
So this is not so.
And there might be a next with music, but I mean, digital seems like at least somewhat of an end game in the sense that this is this tiny file that I put on this big giant box, even to the point where it's an iPod and I can carry around thousands of them with me. So you would imagine digital. Movie is going to be, you know, video is going to be a little longer to get there, But eventually it's going to go that way too. So why am I buying this plastic that I'm just going to have sitting around my house?
Well, what's pretty neat to see as far as innovation goes, and you know, there do seem to be people who are trying to address all this. I know we're leaving Emily in the dust because she hasn't gone to a movie theater in probably ever.
No.
Was E.T. the last movie you saw?
Yeah.
You're saying she was even born before E.T. came out.
No, E.T. was out.
E.T. was out. I couldn't go to it because, you know.
Jared's like 22. Come on.
So, no, but, you know, what you're seeing now, though, is like there are some independent filmmakers, especially if they're just shooting straight on video or something, and they're releasing films directly to peer-to-peer networks. I mean, if you get, like there's an application out there called Vues, right? V-U-S-E, I guess it is, or V-U-Z-E, right? And you could use it to illegally download movies, or you could use it to access what's known as the Vues Network, right, where they actually have legitimate content that's being distributed peer-to-peer. It's kind of like a YouTube situation, but it's just all being done the peer-to-peer network. And there are entire movies being uploaded there initially, you know, and it's actually where they're putting out the original content. So, I mean, it's not like this way of transferring data has to be used for just illicit purposes. There's actually, you know, it could be used, you know, economically. And, you know, as far as, you know, staying to the old theater model, like you said, Jared's got a really good point. I mean, why don't they just buy the theaters? I mean, I mean, the theaters themselves don't make a whole lot of money. They tend to make their money off of all the food they sell. But, you know, you can't pirate food, right? I mean, just...
You can't pirate the experience.
What,
yeah, not yet. That's right.
What a glorious day it'll be when Red Teeth is actually making bootleg popcorn.
Red Teeth.
That's the thing of the pirates. You can't pirate the experience for anything. So
no, you can't.
So... evidently, Hollywood and music, all these industries that are dealing with digital stuff need to do something about, I guess, let go.
Yeah.
Let go and accept that technology is maybe going to move on without you.
Look at your strategic risk of your future operations.
Exactly.
There you go.
Exactly. Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break and be right back with the last segment of the podcast. Stay tuned. Okay, and we're back. Emily, what do you have for us?
Yeah, Belle, I want to talk about Black Friday. Ooh. And crowd control. Black Friday being, you know, the day after Thanksgiving.
I've never heard of it.
All the sales go on. Have you guys ever been out shopping during Black Friday?
I don't know.
Why would you shop
on Thanksgiving? Why would you do that?
Black Friday.
Why? Don't you have a family to go to?
The day after Thanksgiving.
I have a family to go to. I stay with my family.
Pill, welcome to Earth.
Pill. It's the biggest shopping day of the year. Nobody's.
I'm just kidding.
I've done Christmas Eve, but I've never done Black Friday. I've totally shopped on Christmas Eve. It's awesome.
Christmas morning is the way to go.
Nothing's open then. That's the problem.
7-Eleven.
7-Eleven. Get a lot of candy bars and cigarettes. Which is what ends up being everybody's stock.
Here you go, kids. Smoke up.
Who doesn't like candy bars and cigarettes? Christmas morning. So. But Thanksgiving, on the other hand,
this is why I never got to it.
Go ahead.
All right, so you guys may remember last year in Valley Stream, New York.
It's close to my hometown.
Right. There was a Walmart worker who was trampled to death when they opened the Walmart store on Black Friday, the morning of Black Friday. And to try and combat, you know, that chaos, Walmart has instituted, you know, a slew of new rules for this coming season, and one of them is they're just not going to close after Thanksgiving Day. There's going to be no opening of the store the morning on, you know, Friday morning. So the store will stay open. There will be no opening. They're also going to have several different entrances and exits, and there's also going to be a process in place where you have to get a ticket for the item you want. So if you go in and you want a laptop, and
for big ticket items, you mean?
Big ticket items, yes.
Because that's what kind of touched off the rampage last year, right? They had like a crazy sale on flat-screen TVs or something, right?
Yeah, they usually do every year.
They're trying to run across the store to get them.
Right. Now there's going to be a more orderly process in place.
Right.
Where, like, if you want – you have a ticket for the big-screen TV, you have to line up in this line, and it starts at 5 a.m., you know, the sale. But this year they're having $300 laptops and $99 navigation devices. Just a couple of things.
But the sale has to start at some time, no?
The sale starts at 5 a.m. that Friday, but they're never going to close. So you can
camp out in
you
Walmart.
You can just camp in that
night.
Line or whatever.
So it'd be like camping out like the beginning of like a popular movie or something. So you just get in line.
Right.
Right.
But I think the theory is like who's really going to, you know, miss all of Thanksgiving Day just for a navigation device.
Have you seen peopleofwalmart.com? there are some people who do that.
I recommend it. It's some nice
fun. Well, there are people who are willing to get involved in a crazy trampling press last year. I mean people get – I will say people do get kind of nuts when they start shopping after Thanksgiving.
Yes.
And I mean if there's a particular item they're really gunning to get – they really will go to any lengths to get it. So I can see this working for Walmart.
Yeah. The idea of not having people congregate in front of a door and then having everybody in the back of the line, back of the crowd, push those people into the door until the door gives way and either kills someone in the front or someone who was, in this case, employed by Walmart who was behind the door.
Yeah, and the greeters are not the youngest crowd to get out of the way.
No, Yeah.
Although this was a security guard who got killed, right?
No, I don't know. I mean...
He was a temp worker there, just hired for the holiday season. Yeah. I don't know if he was working security.
But
this is not only like a big deal for like the safety of the customers, but it's a huge liability for retailers if they don't, you know, have a plan in place, because this could happen, and you know, it costs Walmart and it could cost other people. Kohl's and Toys R Us, they don't have any sort of plan in place for the Black Friday.
I'm sure not everybody. Yeah, I'm sure for everybody who does, there's probably five that don't.
Probably. So.
Walmart's got the biggest imprint, so anything they do is going to make the news. But
well, people love to give Walmart a really hard time. I mean, it's the world's largest retailer, has no small number of critics. But I got to tell you, I mean, this what happened last year. I mean, it doesn't seem like Walmart did anything wrong necessarily. They just ran a sale, which any other retailer is going to want to do, especially this year. I mean, trying to get into the black, on Black Friday. Is really going to be the big deal. Retailers have had a horrible year, so they're going to want to have as many people rushing into the store, frankly, as possible. But they've got to deal with the safety issue. It seems like what happened at Walmart, frankly, could have happened to any major retailer having a really good sale last year. So I think it's kudos to Walmart, frankly, for addressing it and trying to get something done about it. And hopefully, being the world's biggest retailer, maybe if what they do works, other retailers may follow it, and you could have a positive safety trend start.
Well, so it also would help if you kind of recognize the potential risk and don't have this culture of doorbuster sales and come, be first in on your block to get this and hurry, because you kind of, you get people up in a frenzy and then you go, now we open one door, go.
Yeah.
It's sort of like it's the push for profit and to make it a big, spectacle everybody's got to be involved with, less so for the safety and security of the people who are actually shopping there. It's the whole idea that maybe you want to pay attention to the fact that you're only here as long as your customers are willing to patronize your facility. I don't know.
Well, a few years ago, a bizarre Christmas shopping story happened with me and with the Walmart, and it just sort of speaks to the mentality of people shopping during the holiday season and what retailers are really up against trying to deal with these crowds, right? Because I mean, the art of crowd control is a very interesting one. I mean, you see some industries like amusement parks, for example, and operators within that industry like Disney and Six Flags Great Adventure, both they have some very ingenious, I guess, things that they've done to manage large crowds, to prevent tramplings and presses and that sort of stuff, and they're very good at it, because they've obviously got incentive to do it. But retail stores, you can't build a store like a labyrinth so people can't get through it just to prevent a possibility one day out of the year.
Unless you're IKEA, which seems to make it worse. I don't know if you've ever been through an IKEA.
I love IKEA, but I can't figure out why it's impossible to get through that place quickly. It's kind of strange, but the story is that. All right, so every year for Christmas, we would go up to my parents' place, right? And we'd go up there on Christmas Eve, and we'd exchange presents. And my father was...
Where is up there?
Up there, Easton, Pennsylvania. Sorry. Okay. So we go up to Easton. I live on the Jersey Shore. We drive up there, and, we have, dinner, exchange presents, and we all go home. Then we do the Christmas thing, in the morning at my place. Anyway, so my father is notorious for procrastinating with his Christmas shopping. And we actually got up there Christmas Eve, and it was kind of what Jared was joking about. We get there, and my dad's like, great! The cavalry's arrived. You're going to help me get some presents. And we're like, are you serious? And he's like, oh, yeah, we're going to go.
Dinner's in 2 hours.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, we got all the time we need, right? So we're just going to go. And the only place that was open nearby was Walmart, right? So we went to this Walmart. We're shopping around. And frankly, the store was pretty picked over. I mean, we're looking at
do we get lawn fertilizer?
Yeah.
Or
or like
or potato peelers.
Yeah, cooking mitts, exactly. You know, like, oh, look at this. You know, yeah, yeah. It was pretty slim pickings. And needless to say, my dad impressed.
Your mom likes triple extra large sweatshirts, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Batteries for everyone.
Exactly. Yeah, my father impressed no one that year with what he got for Christmas. But we're halfway through our shopping trip, and all of a sudden, this bulletin goes out over the whole store, basically asking everybody, please stop what you're doing, take what you have in your hands or in your carts, and go to checkout right away. And they left it at that. And the police started coming through, and the staff, and they're actually ushering everybody out of the store. And what happened is the store manager had committed suicide in the back of the store, like, wow. right then and there. Nobody had heard it, but I mean, he had actually killed himself. And you know, news of that kind of quickly got around. You know, people shopping, you're like, oh my god, did you hear this? But the funny thing is that people weren't like freaked out. Oh, I've got to get out of the store. There's a dead guy in the back. People were all like, damn it, I'm not done with my Christmas shopping, because there were a whole bunch of people like my father who were like under the gun. They had to finish their Christmas shopping, and people were actively resisting the police. Like, no, man, I'm going to keep shopping. Like, they had to be physically pushed down the aisle, you know, before they'd get out. They were so just callous about it.
Humanity was removed.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what the holiday season does to people when they're shopping for stuff,
right?
Yeah, but
how does it get that way? It doesn't get that way just because human nature is necessarily going – some sort of circadian rhythm kicks into your head. Now it's around the holidays, so you must shop. It's because the retail environment has made it a pressurized thing that your family will love you just as much as you can buy them the newest toys. And if you don't get them – well, you're a terrible parent, brother, sister, son, daughter, what have you. So you better get into this store real quickly. Now, I mean, yesterday, you know, that's what I'm saying. It's right. Sort of a cultural thing that, I mean, thankfully there's only been, you know, probably a handful of cases of people getting into this sort of thing. But there's always stories like that. You always hear of somebody getting trampled and not necessarily killed. I mean, this case was, you know, a little more tragic than some others, but it's not like the first time I've ever heard
that. Yeah,
this
happens at soccer games,
people
concerts.
Getting into fights all the time over the most trivial things that if it was a different day, they wouldn't be. Yeah. So,
well, it seems like every year or two, there's always some sort of like must-have item that kind of creates a crazy inflated need at that, you know, at that time.
Well, these aren't even the things that Black Friday sales are. Black Friday sales tend to be just like cut-rate items on things, you know, like, oh, we've got a ton of TVs. It's not like
selling for a third
Elmo.
Of the price.
Yeah, right.
The hot toy item usually kind of just happens after a certain point, because it's scarce. Like, people could run all they want to go get Wii's for the past 3 years. Nintendo Wii were just not on sale.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm glad it's good to see that Walmart, though, is kind of
I'm glad they're setting
a
precedent.
Frankly, I'm surprised more incidents like this haven't happened in the past.
Really?
Giving how savage people can get during the holiday times, you know, my local Toys R Us is kind of it seems like it's structured to prevent large crowds from rushing in. Like, when you walk through the front doors, and I don't know if lots of Toys R Us retail locations are like this, or just this one. But you walk in, and there's a big, you know, display wall right in front of you, and you have to kind of like just sort of walk around it, kind of like how some grocery stores have like the produce section. You have to kind of like walk around
and
thread through. It's great because you know it would definitely break up a crowd, right? You know, a crowd could not possibly just blast through the doors because you have to go through this kind of this corridor to turn around before you can spill out and get some traction. So I always wondered if the store is designed like that to prevent a Christmas time rush or something. I don't know.
Right. Well,
maybe they should get some sound blasters too from these pirates.
Some sound
blasters. Tie everything together. If you just put Red Teeth right at the door entrance, I think everybody will be very civil.
Red Teeth stolen toy emporium.
Everybody would be very civil and very orderly.
They have hot sound guns to give away, and you know.
Yes. Well, see, so you bring everything full circle in this podcast. If you were paying attention, everything has had a back reference.
Indeed, it has.
Yeah, and we'll see how well Walmart's plan works.
Come 2 weeks. Thanksgiving. Are you going?
Are you going to go to Walmart that day for some roving reporting?
Well, I'm going to have to now, right? Report back on the next Riskcast.
Does anybody here actually like really plan on doing that sort of stuff? I mean, I'm a kind of guy who waits till Monday.
Yeah, I'm more of a Cyber Monday kind of guy. Yeah,
no, I can't be bothered on the weekend.
What about work?
What about work?
I get in early before work.
Yeah,
I don't abuse my company's time.
No, I fully intend to trample somebody to death on the train running to my computer for Cyber Monday sales.
Monday. See, that's
kick him out of the way. Get out of the way.
Yeah, well, that's much more safe.
Yeah, we'll see how it works out.
So we'll see. So, well, everybody have a safe and happy Thanksgiving, and thanks for listening to the second episode of the podcast. We'll be back in another couple weeks for the third episode. And until then, if you have any comments or questions for us, feel free to shoot us an email at any of our risk management email addresses. Just go to riskmanagementmonitor rmmag.com, that's the site of our blog, or rmmag.com, site of our magazine, or just go to rims.org, which is the master site that runs all of our lives, and you can go there and get any information you need. So, until then, I am Bill Coffin, publisher and editorial director of Risk Management Magazine, and my compadres and I thank you for listening, and we'll catch you again next time. See you later.
See ya.
See ya.
Bye.